I want to thank all the labor unions here in Dane County that help keep SlysOffice.com up and going so you keep up to date, whether it be the Madison Firefighters, Local 311, or the Madison Teamsters, Local 695, or our friends at Madison Teachers Incorporated. These are some of the most active local unions who organize, and constantly stand up for workers. Thank you from SlysOffice.com.
When you're looking for a new computer or need help with one you already own, call 231-8000 and Madison Computer Works will get things up and running for you. Madison Computer Works, computers that work for you.
Welcome to another podcast at SlysOffice.com, brought to you by Madison Computer Works and our friends at Jeff's Guitar Clinic in Fort Atkinson. Joining us now, John Nichols from the Capital Times and The Nation. Comrade Nichols, what did you think of William Barr's performance in front of the Senate the other day?
I can understand why President Trump decided not to expend his personal money to hire Barr as a lawyer, because obviously Barr's not very good at it. And when you can, you know, spend on somebody as good as Rudy Giuliani, of course, that's what you're going to do. But obviously, the president found a way to get publicly funded federal defense counsel. This is like a public defender. And, you know, in that context, he did okay.
The Speaker of the House today came before cameras and called the Attorney General a liar.
The Attorney General of the United States of America was not telling the truth to the Congress of the United States. That's a crime.
She's talking about this moment from April. Barr asked whether he knew Robert Mueller's team was unhappy with his summary of their report.
Members of the special counsel's team are frustrated at some level with the limited information included in your March 24th letter, that it does not adequately or accurately necessarily portray the report's findings. Do you know what they're referencing with that?
No, I don't.
What Barr did know then but did not reveal was that Mueller himself had expressed those same complaints to Barr in an extraordinary letter. On Capitol Hill yesterday, Democrats furious.
Why did you say you were not aware of concerns?
Well, I answered a question. I talked directly to Bob Mueller, not members of his team.
Mr. Barr, I feel your answer was purposely misleading.
You think? That point of distinction is not reality.
That's exactly right. I mean, look, like I suggested, Barr is a good mall lawyer, you know.
And a mall lawyer.
You know, he's got some of the basics. But he would be a better lawyer if when he is kind of lying outright to skilled prosecutors or in the company of skilled prosecutors, he was maybe just a little bit more nuanced in his approach, right? You know, it's kind of a weak spot when they've got tape. You know what I'm saying? And one of the things to understand is that Barr may, you know, kind of make an impression on somebody like Trump or on people on Fox or something like that when he's doing these games and, you know, kind of like his "I'm really bored to be here" stuff. But most of the Democrats on the Judiciary panel have real experience in government and the law. And like when Patrick Leahy asked him a question, Leahy's a former prosecutor. He was a prosecutor in, you know, I think the most populous county in Vermont. Kamala Harris is former prosecutor, one of the most populous counties in California, and then the attorney general of that state. Sheldon Whitehouse, a former U.S. attorney and attorney general. These are people who are very, very experienced.
Well, let's play some of those clips. Here we go.
Yeah, there you go.
Going forward, what if a foreign adversary, let's now say North Korea, offers a presidential candidate dirt on a competitor in 2020. Do you agree with me the campaign should immediately contact the FBI? If a foreign intelligence service, a representative of a foreign government,
yes,
says, we have dirt on your opponent,
yes,
should they say, I love it, let's meet,
if
or should they contact the FBI?
If a foreign intelligence service does, yes.
Yeah, and of course, we all know what that point of distinction is. If it's an oligarch acting on behalf of a government, of course, no problem. Here's another one.
Attorney General Barr, has the president or anyone at the White House ever asked or suggested that you open an investigation of anyone? Yes or no?
Could you repeat that question?
I will repeat it.
Yeah.
Has the president or anyone at the White House ever asked or suggested that you open an investigation of anyone? Yes or no, please, sir?
The president or anybody else.
Seems you'd remember something like that and be able to tell us.
Yeah, but I'm trying to grapple with the word suggest. I mean, there have been discussions of matters out there that they have not asked me to open an investigation, but
perhaps they've suggested.
I don't know. I wouldn't say suggest.
Hinted.
I don't know.
Inferred. You don't know. Okay.
That's my favorite moment.
It was fantastic. And I mean, Kamala Harris right there. You know, if you say what you want about her running for president and favor her or oppose her, take your stand on that, that's a separate thing from this. But, man, she is a good, good prosecutor and a very effective senator. Do you know what I love the best about that? It wasn't the core question. It was the, I will repeat the question. You know, that very chipper. Yes, I'll be delighted to do that, sir. And it was like, there was such strength, such confidence there. She knew that the second he didn't say no to that question, that she had him. And you understand that the Attorney General of the United States suggested, inferred, and hinted in his I don't know answer there that the point of her question, this question of whether the administration is essentially putting pressure on the Department of Justice to politicize the process, is a reality.
And here, of course, is another clip from yesterday, or the day before yesterday's testimony. Let's see. This is Cory Booker and another clip of Kamala Harris.
We have a document that shows over 200 connections between a presidential campaign and a foreign adversary, sharing information that would be illegal if you did it with a super PAC. We know that. But
what
sharing,
information was shared?
The polling data was shared, sir. It's in the report. I can cite you the page.
With who?
You accepted the report as the evidence?
Yes.
You did not question or look at the underlying evidence that supports the conclusions in the report?
No.
So, Jeremy Bash.
So there you go. That's a pretty remarkable thing. Great lawyer,
well,
huh?
Well, it gets to the, kind of weakness of William Barr as a lawyer. Anybody who thinks that answer was cute, or as some people use, combative, right, or any of these phrases. No. When you are the Attorney General of the United States, you have dealt with the most high-profile report that will come into your hands during the course, not merely of your current Attorney General service, but arguably of the era, right? I mean, whether you like the Mueller report or not, it's a big deal. And you reduce that report to a four-page memo. The critical question, right, is what do you know about the report, right? It's simple. You need to read the whole thing. You need to have a good sense of it, an understanding of it. Sly, the stuff about Manafort sharing the polling data is one of the most talked about things in the report.
I know, even before the report came out.
Yes, but before it came out, but also the second it was released, right? I mean, it went to the top of the list. I've written about it. Everybody, everybody's paying attention to this stuff, has written about it.
Which is why when he said in his four-page summary that came out first, no collusion, when, of course, Mueller wasn't investigating collusion, he was, right? There was collusion. That's collusion.
Well, right? It
may not be illegal, but it was certainly of note.
Yeah, and you know the thing is that this notion that collusion is a legal concept. It's a word. It describes cooperation.
Conspiracy is the crime.
The concept, right?
Right.
And with Manafort, it's a pretty good bet. There's a conspiracy going on, in anything he's doing, just about. But the bottom line here is that what Barr did there, that suggestion of, well, what do you mean, or polling, what is that about? I mean, it rises to a level of disrespect for the process, either a disrespect in his own role, right, where he is simply not up to the job of being attorney general, not competent enough, right? Just doesn't have it. Because any lawyer is sort of racing through things and not actually reading the information and stuff like that. Maybe you need somebody else. Or disrespect for the oversight process, i.e. you come prepared, you give honest answers, you participate sincerely in it. But whatever it is, I can tell you, I would suggest to you that in another era, just that exchange right there might well have brought an accusation of contempt, even discussion of censure.
Here is Nancy Pelosi the other day.
As you probably know, when the articles of impeachment for President Nixon, Article 3 was that he ignored the subpoenas of Congress, that he did not honor the subpoenas of Congress. This is very, very serious. But my judgment will spring from the judgment of our committee chairs.
Did she just tip her hand there, John?
I think so. And I think that frankly, as you know, I've been somewhat critical of her for her handling of a lot of this. I think I don't like the idea of ever taking impeachment or censure or any accountability power or tool off the table. And she too frequently does that.
All right. But I think
what she's doing here is a big deal.
All right.
She is saying, I'll defer to the committee chairs.
Right. I think taking it off the table is a mistake. I think not rushing to judgment or saying, look, we're going to go through a process is not a mistake, because that's a mistake that, well, the Republicans made a lot of mistakes in 1998, but they didn't even hold hearings. They just raced into it.
Right. And they were punished horribly for it, right?
Right.
They got continued control of the House. They got the presidency in the next election. It was a nightmare scenario.
Well, that's a little bit, you did skip over the fact that the Democrats obviously did not take the hit in the midterm election that they would have had the Republicans not overplayed their hand. So they did pay a little bit of a price immediately.
A little bit, but that's the important thing for people to understand.
No, but let's not forget that they handled that very poorly.
They were comic. They were like Keystone Cops. What I would suggest is, I just did an interview the other day with Jamie Raskin, the former American University law professor who now sits in a key role on the Judiciary Committee. And Jamie Raskin, in this interview, went in great detail into the Nixon impeachment and the very wise, very careful process that was developed there, one that really did seek bipartisan support and jettisoned many proposed articles of impeachment because they didn't get the level of support they needed but went with the core ones. And then he looked at the Clinton impeachment, and he was very, very blunt. He said, we would never do that. We would never imagine that a personal foible of this type is something that would rise up to what we're looking at. And I do think that the Judiciary Committee at this point have in their head, can, you know, very carefully and very ably contain in their head what worked about the Nixon impeachment, what didn't work about the Clinton impeachment. And as Raskin says, and this is, I think, one of the wiser approaches to it, and one that I think Pelosi understands, has come to understand, and that is that impeachment should never be a fetish. It shouldn't be something that you just do because you think it would be fun. Or
fetish?
Interesting.
Wow.
Yeah. But it should also never be a taboo, something you never do.
Interesting.
Right? So our, very good turn of phrase there.
Well, it is interesting as we wrap things up here for this part that the Democrats are getting all the heat and the media's, oh, there's a divide, you know. And the Republicans seem to be completely getting a pass for complete obstruction, for completely abrogating their responsibility as members of Congress or members of the Senate. There's very little heat on them. They see the media seems completely unfocused on the Republicans.
Well, and look, I have been embarrassed by some of the media coverage of this, right? Because they don't always. Sometimes they do, and there's some excellent coverage, but they don't always seem to be able to rise to the occasion, right? To understand that when the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee is saying, I'm going to give the Attorney General a couple more days to cooperate with us, you know, you're teetering on the edge of a constitutional crisis of historic significance.
Yeah.
And you ought to, at that point, you ought to pause and maybe, you know, get rid of the kind of party hangers-on who sometimes comment on things and get some actual lawyers in there.
Stand by. We'll talk more. Slysoffice.com.
Similar to a well-tuned automobile, a guitar requires the same level of attention to perform at its very best. No matter how expensive your guitar may be, we will treat you and your instrument with the utmost respect. Call 920-723-1733 or visit jeffsguitar.com. Jeff's Guitar Clinic in Fort Atkinson. We love guitars.
We're back at slysoffice.com, brought to you by Madison Firefighters, Local 311, Madison Teachers Incorporated, and, of course, Madison Teamsters, Local 695. All right. The race for president is heating up because Joe Biden is in the race. Things are starting to develop. Clearly, the two front runners in the race are Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders. Last night, Bernie Sanders was on with Chris Hayes.
You know, one of the reasons that I've watched a bunch of healthcare fights, I watched the ACA fight. I've watched the repeal of the ACA fight. And if there's a common through line in them, it is status quo bias. It is people are scared of change, and with good reason, because change in healthcare is terrifying because it has to do with your life. So I guess I'm just not quite convinced the idea that you need to meet him with some alternative when people are so in a defensive crouch about this incredibly frontal assault on what they have.
Well, I don't quite agree with you, Chris. I mean, I think there is profound disgust at a healthcare system which is by far the most expensive in the world, double what other countries are paying, where we have 34 million people without any health insurance, even more who are underinsured, where the pharmaceutical industry is ripping us off every day, charging us by far the highest prices in the world, where you have insurance companies and drug companies making billions and billions of dollars in profit, paying their CEOs outrageous compensation packages. I think the American people want something that's stable. Medicare for all is the most popular health insurance program in the country. It is not a radical idea over a four-year period to expand it to the rest of the population.
You know, it's so funny because he didn't just slightly disagree with Chris Hayes. He completely disagreed with Chris Hayes.
Yeah. And I think that where he went to is, you know, kind of goes to the, you know, kind of heart of the matter here as regards 2020. And I'm seeing an interesting divide develop, right? Clearly, Sanders has signaled that he is going to go all in on this. He is going to run as a change agent, somebody who says, you know, this election has to have meaning. It has to really shift course, not just from Trump, but from sort of the politics that made Trump possible. That in, by having a dramatically clear distinction, A, that makes it easier to beat Trump, but also it makes it easier to go forward. That gets to the heart of what he talked about going back now 5 years, this idea of a political revolution, i.e., it's a big shift. It's like, you know, Roosevelt, New Deal, the 30s. There are an awful lot of Democrats who operate in another, Democrats, progressives, commentators, a lot of folks who operate in a different mode, and they think they can get this one a little softer, right? That they can beat Trump and sort of get back to where things were, you know? And that's an, I mean, I think I've always shown my sentiments. I tend to be much more toward the idea that you really need the big message. But that's a legitimate
division. Well, doesn't the future necessitate it? The piece that ran in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about 1 in 4 jobs in Wisconsin disappearing because of automation, obviously in retail, in farming, in manufacturing, the gig economy. I mean, is it fair to say that Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, is already antiquated?
Totally.
That sort of system is still predicated on having a job from an employer. And the buy-in is still too expensive for a lot of people, for people that are self-employed.
Buy-in is too expensive, and also the payout is too expensive if you actually have an illness, an injury, something, you know what I mean?
It's, right.
On both levels, it doesn't work. And it doesn't work for where we're headed. Look, the fact of the matter is we don't have very much time to begin to structure the next economy. Countries around the world are already doing it. Right, Germany is on something called Work 4.0. They're so far down the line on figuring out how they're going to deal with this. And you know what? At the heart of their Work 4.0 stuff is a restructuring of social welfare, of healthcare benefits, education, all sorts of other things. And so, the countries that are going to win the race toward the future are taking this very, very seriously right now, and I think that the notion that you can just kind of come out of the 2020 election, maybe beat Trump, and then just sit in your lawn chair, right, sigh and go, "Well, glad that's over." No, what the biggest crisis of Donald Trump's presidency is that we're losing 4 critical years to deal with, obviously, the existential threat of climate change, but also the race toward an automated future. And the AI automation model, and it's nothing complicated about this. This isn't, you don't have to learn about every gigabyte and every bell and whistle. All you need to understand is that the smartest, most powerful people in the world are trying to figure out how to have a lot less people working to find jobs.
All right. Which leads us to this next clip. It appears as though maybe Joe Biden is a little rusty or hasn't been paying attention to the world.
I ask you about something you tweeted the other day about China. You said, since the China trade deal I voted against, America has lost over 3 million manufacturing jobs. It's wrong to pretend that China isn't one of our major economic competitors. When we are in the White House, we will win that competition by fixing our trade policies. That appeared to be a response to something Joe Biden said, and I want to play what he said and then ask you squarely if, in fact, you're responding. Here's what Joe Biden said.
China is going to eat our lunch? Come on, man. They can't even figure out how to deal with the fact that they have this great division between the China Sea and the mountains in the east, I mean, in the west. They can't figure out how they're going to deal with the corruption that exists within the system. I mean, they're not bad folks, but guess what? They're not competition for us.
So were you responding to the former vice president with that tweet?
If you don't tell anybody else, Chris.
I mean, clearly you were, but here's
the point.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah.
And then I'll respond.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, the point that we wanted to make is I happen to believe that our trade policies over the years have been a disaster for workers in this country. If you add the job loss as a result of NAFTA, which Joe voted for, Joe is a friend of mine, and we're going to have this policy discussion in a very civil way. But Joe voted for NAFTA, he voted for PNTR with China. Add those two trade policies together, you're probably talking about the loss of more than 4 million jobs. And by the way, a race to the bottom in this country where many employers lowered wages and threatened their workers if they didn't like that, they would move to China or to Mexico. So I happen to think that China is obviously, I mean, it is one of the fastest growing economies in the world over the last 20 years. And I think that we need a trade policy with China that is based on principles of fairness, not unfettered free trade.
Well, so let me just to give the a sort of version of what the vice president seemed to be saying. It seemed to me that part of what he's saying is that this is not a zero-sum proposition in the way that Donald Trump thinks about it. I mean, part of the things right now is that Donald Trump says any gain by anyone else is a loss for us. A gain for China is a loss for us, a gain for Mexico. Right. And that seems like a bad way of thinking about the way that the global economy works, right? I mean, China and the U.S. can grow together.
Absolutely. And look, China deserves credit. If I'm not mistaken, China has done a better job in wiping out desperate levels of poverty over, you know, a 30, 40-year period than any country in history, and they deserve credit for that. So I am not anti-China, but we have got to establish trade policies which do not allow corporate America to simply shut down in this country and refuse to pay workers here a decent wage and move to countries around the world where they're paying people pennies an hour. And one of the things that I would do is use the leverage of the federal government to say to those profitable companies that if you want to shut down here and move abroad, and then you think you're going to come in and get federal contracts, you know, you might want to think again. We want you to be a good corporate citizen and not just treat your workers in a disparaging and disdainful way.
All right.
So the distinction is started. Sorry, that was a long clip, but I thought you'd want to hear the whole thing. Yeah.
No, that's important. And that's, look, that was important, that distinction, because it does show a clear difference between where Biden's coming from, which is, frankly, not healthy politically. I mean, this notion of that the Chinese aren't our equals or something like that. I mean, it's the fact of the matter is that they've got really smart people doing really savvy stuff as regards the global economy. And so Biden, you push him to the side and say, okay, that's somebody talking from like 1977 there. Sanders has a better response. But it's important to understand that where Sanders is coming from there is still, you know, an old response in many senses, right? It's trying to clean up our trade messes.
Well, jobs still are going to China.
That's what I mean. No, it's not a bad response, but I'm saying it is not. It's not the whole thing.
But I think the distinction he's making is a values distinction.
Totally.
Because Joe Biden is selling himself as a big labor man. Well, the Guardian actually put out an opinion piece. I can't remember who wrote it, saying Joe Biden is no friend of labor.
But I want to take it to the next stage though, and say I agree with you totally. It's the values thing that matters most. If you didn't get trade right 25 years ago, I mean, if you didn't get NAFTA, if you didn't get China free trade, at those critical stages, there are choices that you made, the ways that you kind of organized your worldview, that are not going to work in this next stage as regards automation. And as regards AI technology and all this, all these changes in the work world that we're about to experience, that we are experiencing, you have to have a worldview that begins with the idea that working people have to be taken care of, whether they're in China or in the U.S. But the core thing is that you start with them, not with corporate profits. And
well, can we use the Socratic method here to go down Joe Biden's judgment over the years? Okay. Did Joe Biden get it right in the late 70s when he fought off an attempt to end right-to-work states in the United States? Did he get that right? Did he get PNTR with China right? Did he get NAFTA right? Did he get GATT right? Did he get the bankruptcy bill right? Did he get the federal crime bill right? Did he get the Iraq war right? How about the Persian Gulf War? Did he get any of those things right, John?
Can I add Glass-Steagall?
Repealing Glass-Steagall? Yes.
What about the Patriot Act?
The Patriot
Act. Can we get up to a dozen?
I'm sure there's a few we missed.
Anita Hill.
You know, that one I'm going to give him a little bit of a pass on, but, you know, whatever.
You're more generous than I. Look, as you well know, I have covered Joe Biden for a very long time, and I have actually written things that were positive about some of the stuff he's done over the course of his career. But the list that you ran down goes to the heart of the matter. And the challenge is this. As best I can see at this point, and I do believe people can change. I do believe people can progress. But the challenge at this point is that if Joe Biden runs as an extension of who he has been and as the embodiment of the, you know, historic kind of centrist Democratic Party compromise, that will make Donald Trump very, very happy.
Amen. 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 Which is why my epiphany, I've been sort of holding back. My epiphany was when Donald Trump was speaking in Green Bay last week, and he was going down the litany of things that have happened because of trade to Wisconsin. Now, he's in kind of a hole because of some of his policies on agriculture and tariffs that have put him in a hole in Wisconsin.
Yeah.
But truth be told, everybody's focusing, oh, Joe Biden, Pennsylvania, Western Pennsylvania. Joe Biden has this bond with unions, and there is some of that, but the truth is, there's a lot of people that are working that A, aren't in unions, but have been affected by these policies, but B, I think maybe some of the union leaders are more enthralled with Joe Biden than some of their members.
Well, you had that issue back in 2016 as well.
Right.
And so here's the bottom line. We need to, on this one, move up to 30,000 feet. Usually I like being down in the weeds.
I'm getting air sickness.
I know. You don't fly that often. But I'm going to tell you up here, if we look at this, you and I happen to be talking at a point where the latest economic figures just came out, right? The United States is creating a lot of jobs right now. And the U.S. is hitting some record-level GDP growth in a period, you know, extended GDP growth, things like that. I don't know how long that's going to play out. But I can tell you that if it does play out into the 2020 election cycle, into the core of it, Donald Trump is going to run for re-election saying a lot of jobs, improving economy, rising wages, going to run down that list. And a Democrat who doesn't have a deeply nuanced, smart, kind of multi-tier, multi-level, knowing, forward-looking approach that recognizes the weaknesses and vulnerabilities in the economy is just going to be shredded.
Yeah, and just talking about Charlottesville ain't going to do the trick.
Well, it helps. It's important because it does. Huh. Mobilizing people is important in that regard. But here's the one thing I would add to the mix. You got to talk about Charlottesville. It's important. You can't neglect it.
That's not what I said. What I said was just talking about Charlottesville won't do the trick.
But this is what I'm going to say, because so often you and I say the same thing. You got to also talk about Chilton. And you're like, whoa, wait a minute, Chilton? What's up with that? Well, one of the primary, heart of a county, is one of the primary milk-producing counties in the United States, dairy farming. And the fact of the matter is, dairy farmers are in absolute crisis in Wisconsin. Farmers across the upper Midwest are in absolute crisis. And the counterpoint to all of that great, quote-unquote, economic news for Donald Trump that Donald Trump can use is a scorching farm crisis. in precisely the states he has to win. The fact of the matter is, if you can tip farmers in Michigan and Wisconsin and Iowa, and maybe
Ohio,
you have the potential for a Democratic win that, yes, does build on the base of deep frustration with Donald Trump's racism and xenophobia and all of those other problems, but then brings in an additional group of people, and you build out a real coalition. It is getting a little bit, dare I say it, toward the New Deal coalition.
Got to wrap it up. John Nichols from the Capital Times and the Nation. Thanks for coming to SliceOffice.com.
SliceOffice.com.
Thanks a million.
Bye-bye.